Hey everyone, Josh here. Over the last 6 months on this show, we've been covering COVID-19 a lot, obviously. And a big theme that's emerged is how this virus has hit some people harder than others. I'm talking about people of color who are more likely to get sick and die. The elderly and low-income people, migrant workers, people with addictions, and prisoners. You can find all those episodes in our feed. And as we head into the next stretch of life under COVID, we're going to stick with this theme. But we want to apply it to the economic and social recovery. And so we have a whole series about it called Year K. Why Year K? Because some economists think that the recovery could take that shape. You have some people heading up into the black, where the money's good, and others heading down into the red, into debt and into uncertainty. Today's show very much fits that theme. We're looking at one proposal intended to keep everyone's head above water. Here it is.
On disability, Ontario Disability Support Program. My husband works full-time. We still couldn't make ends meet. There is a clawback on his employment off of our check, and with increased costs in hydro and heat, we were looking at having to sell the house. But the rents are so high now, too.
This is Tracy Mashevsky. She and her husband live in the small town of Lindsay, Ontario.
Groceries, as they became more expensive, we found ourselves quite often going to the food bank. That was terribly stigmatizing too. So it was really a terrible rock and a hard place situation to be in. And then the basic income pilot came along.
In 2017, Tracy became one of 4,000 low-income Ontarians to join one of the world's largest basic income pilot programs.
That we'll be launching here in the Hamilton area and in two other Ontario communities, Lindsay and the Thunder Bay area. It's a great thing.
It was started by the former Ontario Liberal government under Kathleen Wynne. And the plan was to pay participants up to $17,000 a year for 3 years, no strings attached.
It says to them, government is with you. The people of Ontario are with you.
And the idea was to study the impact of a universal basic income. Tracy says the extra money changed her life.
We didn't have to worry about where to get food. We could pay all our bills with just a small hand up, not a hand out, because we made everything work. We were not only able to pay our bills, but I was also able to start a business that I've wanted to do for years. I took out a personal loan and I used that to start the business, knowing that I'd have these guaranteed income payments to pay the loan down. The dignity that I felt to be able to say I'm owner and operator of a business.
Tracy also has chronic pain and mobility issues, and she says those improved too.
With the extra money, I took out a membership to the YMCA. I started swimming every day that I had the opportunity. In the 3 years from the start of the basic income, I've lost 100 pounds. I've lost six sizes.
In 2018, when Doug Ford ran for premier, he promised to keep the basic income pilot going. But after his government came to power, they decided to cancel it.
The Liberals presided over a disjointed patchwork system with no interest at all in whether these programs delivered results.
Social Services Minister Lisa McLeod said the program failed to help people become independent contributors to the economy.
Yeah, it ran for a year and a half out of the three before it got canceled, which has now left me in a financial crisis because I don't have the money to pay the personal loan back because I had projected the 3 years. So unfortunately, I'm worse off than when I started the basic income because of the government's decision to cancel it.
So Ontario may have scrapped its UBI pilot, but the concept still has some political life in it. Quite a lot, actually, because right now it has emerged as a top priority inside the Federal Liberal Party heading into their convention in November. Today, a primer on UBI. I'm Josh Block. This is Front Burner. My guest today is Max Fawcett. He's a freelance journalist who's written about this for The Walrus and elsewhere. Hello, Max.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for having me on.
So, you know, I know that UBI can take a number of different forms, but generally, what is the principle behind it and how does it work?
Yeah, so like you say, there's a lot of different configurations that it can take, but at its most basic form, the idea is rather than funding programs and services that target people who are low income or who need social assistance, you just send them a check. The idea is that by giving people money, letting them choose what they want to do with it, rather than trying to get them to apply for programs, deliver the programs, it's a more efficient way of delivering social support.
Right. And the federal government is now figuring out their policy priorities ahead of their November convention. And guaranteed basic income is now at the top of their list of priorities, of policies. How did that become such a mainstream idea in Canada?
Yeah, it's kind of breathtaking how fast it's moved from a pretty fringe, you know, policy wonk idea to something that is so clearly in the mainstream. You know, I think like a lot of things, we have COVID to thank or blame for that, depending on how you sit here. I think people who have received the CERB over the last few months, and I think it's helped millions of Canadians. It's probably saved millions of Canadians in a lot of respects.
As a classical guitarist, Andrew Ma is used to not having a regular paycheck. But COVID dried up everything from his performances to teaching gigs to his side hustle as a sound engineer.
Before CERB, it was a life of terror for a while there. I think now, at this point, it's getting a little bit terrifying again.
That's opened a lot of people's eyes to the value of a program like this, because the CERB is basically a guaranteed income in stealth. It really has all the hallmarks of a guaranteed income. But I think it's also opened a lot of people's eyes who didn't previously understand the need and suddenly had the need introduced to them by the pandemic and the economic response to it. I think they have more empathy now for a program like this. So, you know, I don't think a UBI would have been politically possible a year ago. I'm not even sure it'll be politically possible a year from now. But right now, in this moment, where we're all sort of highly attuned to the value of this kind of direct support, maybe that's exactly the moment that a UBI needs.
And it seems that some amount of credit should go to Andrew Yang, the former Democratic presidential candidate, who really, I think, put this on the map for a lot of people. It was the whole focus of his campaign. He pledged that, you know, if he became president, he would give every American $1,000 a month.
This is the move that we have to make, particularly as technology is now automating away millions of American jobs. It's why Donald Trump is our president today, that we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And we're about to do the same thing to millions of retail jobs, call center jobs.
Agreed. Yeah, I think Andrew Yang's candidacy and the way he sort of made it a single issue candidacy was really interesting. And it definitely put this on the map for people who didn't already know about it. He showed people that this was not a crazy idea, that this was not a, you know, socialist idea, that this was something a relatively conservative business person, an entrepreneur, supported.
But it would also lead to 2 million new jobs because of all the economic activity. And it would make our labor force much more dynamic, because right now a lot of Americans are stuck in place and are having a hard time moving for different opportunities.
I want to ask you about some of the basic income trials that have happened previously. You know, we heard from Tracy Macheski at the start of this episode and how she felt that a basic income had really improved her life. How consistent was her experience with other people in the Ontario UBI pilot program?
You know, with the caveat that we don't have a ton of data from that program because the Ford government cut it short, the data we do have seems pretty interesting. There was a professor at McMaster who kind of gathered this data, interviewed a bunch of people who were involved in the program, and you have these really sort of overwhelmingly positive benefits in terms of people's levels of stress, their health outcomes, the number of times they went to the hospital, the amount of alcohol and tobacco they used, and even, you know, the jobs that they worked and the jobs they applied to.
Professor Luchak, you did in-depth interviews. You got to know the stories these people had. Is there any particular one that stands out for you?
I remember one individual who basically said, look, I was on the edge of suicide. I just felt that nobody cared about me. I didn't know how to make ends meet. And I'm now looking forward to becoming a more productive citizen and a part of this community.
It's hard to find a bad part of this pilot program, and it's sort of frustrating that it wasn't allowed to run its course. But this is sort of one of the challenges that UBI has always had, is that we have these pilot programs in certain places. There was, you know, there was a flurry of them in the 70s, including ones in Manitoba. We just had one wrap up in Finland.
The goal? To give unemployed people a safety net to find work or even start a business. But the trial has ended, and now researchers say there was almost no effect on unemployment.
But the numbers are always small. It's always, you can always dismiss the data as, well, that's just a few thousand people.
Well, I was so interested to learn that Canada's like first trial, even though it sounds like one of the first trials in the world, was that the trial in Manitoba, in Dauphin, Manitoba, in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. It was called Mincom.
If a family member earned an additional income, then the Mincom payments were taxed back at a rate of 50%. That is, for every dollar a person made working, 50 cents of the Mincom money had to be returned to the government.
What did we learn from that trial?
It depends on who you ask. That's sort of the interesting thing about these sorts of trials, is that, you know, we're not doing a drug trial. We're not doing something that has clear scientific boundaries where you can go, well, you know, either the vaccine worked or the vaccine didn't work. So the Mincom experiments, if you ask people who were supportive of it, they said, well, it had all these really beneficial social outcomes in terms of, you know, people being able to leave abusive relationships, in terms of people having better health outcomes, in terms of people being able to apply for better jobs.
We're small farmers. I think that we didn't do as much seeding. We had less livestock, and this income was a great help to us.
Yeah, just as I was working. If I made more money, I get hardly anything, but I still worked. I didn't stop working.
And then if you ask the people who worry that guaranteed incomes would make people lazy, not want to work, There was a small impact in terms of people's willingness to work, and they point to that and go, "We'll see. It proves what we said all along. This is a bad idea. It'll turn us all into sloths."
It was hard to get the help from guys that were taking Mincom, and I thought it wasn't a very good idea after all.
What do you mean? What do you mean it was hard to get help from guys who?
Well, when guys were taking Mincom, you asked them for some help to get on a tractor or to help you on a farm. They wouldn't go and help you because they said they're taking Mincom.
So, you know, it really kind of depended on which side of the issue you sat on, and as a result, it didn't give a comprehensive, conclusive result. And we're still sort of in that space where we have a lot of good circumstantial evidence. We don't have anything definitive, or we didn't until the last few months. And that's sort of the magic of the CERB over the last few months, is that's exactly what has happened. We have basically had a trial.
I know that there was this health economist at the University of Manitoba, Evelyn L. Forget, who found a whole trove of documents about in 2008 that came from that 1970s trial. And she concluded from that, you know, admittedly small study, that it was actually a pretty good return on investment.
And some of that is going to come back in the form of reduced upward pressure on the healthcare system. This is a country that right now is spending about $60 billion a year, more than $60 billion a year on hospitals. So if you see an 8.5% reduction in hospitalizations, that's a pretty dramatic saving.
Absolutely. I mean, I think part of the problem is that when we look at this, and this is going to be an issue if the government does decide to implement a federal UBI right now, is we look at the headline cost. And at the federal level, it's going to be a big number. It's going to be a very big number. The problem is the return comes a lot later. And that's really kind of been one of the challenges with people who have tried to advocate for it in the past, is it just looks like a new cost. It doesn't look like something that will save money.
Well, I want to dig into the criticism a bit further, because there is a lot of criticism, and interestingly, it comes from across the political spectrum. I want to start with the conservative arguments against UBI. What are some of the main arguments that conservatives make against this kind of program?
They tend to be fairly ideological and revolve around, you know, sort of, I think we all know about the idea that, you know, you got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And this is definitely counter to that. This is the government effectively giving you some bootstraps. And you've seen it actually expressed during the current sort of COVID debate around the wage subsidies and the CERB, them saying, well, what's going to encourage someone to go work at a minimum wage job, or you know, how are businesses going to be able to hire people if people can just choose to stay home and get paid by the government?
At this Halifax hotel, there are beds to be made, bathrooms to be cleaned, but most of the staff are still at home in no rush to come back to work.
They're talking about making almost as much money, well, a few hundred dollars less to stay at home under that program. And so it takes a little bit of encouragement to get them back.
But yeah, the conservative critique revolves around the fact that this might chip away at our work ethic.
Interestingly, there's also been some support from conservative thinkers in Canada, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Look, you know, Hugh Siegel, who was a longtime conservative operative thinker, he was a senator. He's written books about why a UBI is important and a good idea.
Because I see how the present programs are operating. So when you have a program that spends that kind of money and we don't achieve that kind of meaningful progress of any kind, I say to myself, as a conservative who's concerned about how taxpayers' money is spent, we can be doing this better, more efficiently, and more effectively.
You know, there is absolutely a conservative case for a UBI. The argument they've made is, and this sort of leads into the critique from the left, is a UBI is a good way to replace government programs. So their belief is that government support programs can be inefficiently administered. They don't reach the right people. There's friction there. There's inefficiency. And conservatives who want less government would be very happy to replace, you know, any number of social programs with a check, right? There's fewer bureaucrats. There's less government involvement. You're effectively empowering people to make their own decisions. There's a lot of things there that tick boxes that are on the conservative score sheet.
I also saw that the Business Council of Alberta, which is an organization, you know, founded by a number of pipeline executives, have also defended this kind of, even if a temporary UBI during the pandemic. And it seems like part of the argument is that you need to get money into the hands of people if you want the economy to stay afloat.
Absolutely. There is definitely a business case for a UBI as well. And the Business Council of Alberta came out fairly early supporting this, which I think definitely turned a lot of heads, certainly out here in Calgary. But if you're a small business, if you're a restaurant right now, if you're a retailer, and boy, you're really not doing very well, the best way to help you is to get people spending again. And that's why you have, or at least had, I haven't checked with him recently, but you had people like Ken Bozenkool, who you know, is a well-respected conservative thinker and staffer to many conservative politicians. He was very supportive of a temporary UBI for exactly that reason.
Okay, and I know you mentioned that there is significant opposition to UBI from the left. Why do some people on the left think that UBI is not a good idea?
Their concern, and it's a concern that dates back, you know, 30 or 40 years now, is that a UBI will be an opportunity to get rid of social programs. And in doing that, you end up hurting the people who need the help the most.
John Clark of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty does worry that the program is a move to the eventual privatization of social services.
So you're shopping for healthcare, you're shopping for housing, you're shopping for public transportation, childcare, all these things. And this is the prevailing agenda at the moment, and a basic income system takes us in that direction.
So if our operating principle here is a UBI is needed to help people who are struggling, it doesn't make much sense to then take out programs that disproportionately benefit people who are struggling. If you're somebody who depends on the government for, you know, educational support for your autistic child, replacing the existing government programs you have with a check for $1,200 a month or whatever it might be is not going to cut the mustard. That's going to put you in a much deeper hole than you were in before. It's going to make your life a lot more difficult. And I do think that that is something the government has to be extremely attentive to. This will not work if it is a program that makes the lives of those who are already struggling that much harder.
So when it comes to a possible rollout of UBI in Canada, what are you going to be watching for?
Well, like, I'll be watching for the throne speech that's coming up shortly. I think we'll see the signals there, whether the government is prepared to make this move or if this is, you know, them testing and seeing what the popular reaction is. But I'm not going to put the odds at 100% because nothing is 100% in Canadian politics. But I'd say the odds of us having a universal basic income by this time next year are higher than they've ever been in anyone's life.
Max, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
Some news for you before we go about the first general election in Canada since the start of the pandemic. Last night, the Progressive Conservative Party won a majority in New Brunswick after 2 years of minority government. Premier Blaine Higgs called the snap election back in August when there was disagreement between political parties on whether the PC government should stay in power until the end of the pandemic or the next fixed election date in 2022. Higgs spent much of the four-week campaign talking about the need for stability in these unprecedented times and his government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic in New Brunswick. That's all for today. Thanks for listening to Front Burner.